Hecatra podcast conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Hecatra AI. Welcome, everyone. Today we are diving deep into a text that, well, really shook the world. The Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels.
Absolutely. It's a document that's been incredibly influential, sparking debate, and frankly shaping economic and political thinking for, what, 175 years now?
Easily.
And our mission today isn't really about taking sides in those debates. It's more about cutting through some of the noise, you know, getting to the core structure, the actual ideas Marx and Engels put down on paper back in 1848.
Exactly. Because regardless of your own views, understanding this framework is, I think, really valuable. It gives you a kind of analytical lens.
Mm.
It helps make sense of modern issues like inequality, globalization, even that feeling, you know, that sense of alienation lots of people feel in their jobs today. It teaches you to look systemically.
It's a powerful tool for critical thinking, definitely.
Okay, so let's start with the authors themselves, Marx and Engels. What did they each bring to this partnership? It was quite a combination, wasn't it?
It really was. So Karl Marx, he was the main theorist, you could say. A philosopher by training, he spent years weaving together different strands of thought.
Like what specifically?
Well, German idealist philosophy, Hegelian dialectics, for example, French socialist ideas, and crucially, the sort of rigorous analysis of British classical economics.
Right. He synthesized those. Yeah. And what was the big idea he developed from that about how society works?
His key contribution is what we call historical materialism. It's this fundamental idea that history isn't driven by great men or abstract ideas so much as by the real material conditions of life.
Meaning
how people organize themselves to produce what they need to survive. The economic base, essentially.
Okay. And then there's Friedrich Engels. He wasn't just another academic, which is kind of surprising, right?
That's the really fascinating part, I think. Engels came from wealth. His father was a German textile manufacturer. So Engels had this direct, practical, firsthand experience of industrial capitalism. He actually managed the family factory in Manchester.
Manchester, the heart of the Industrial Revolution at the time.
Exactly. So he saw the brutal conditions of the working class up close. It wasn't just theory for him. It was documented reality.
So you had Marx's deep theoretical mind combined with Engels' sort of street-level knowledge of industry. That's quite potent.
It's precisely that combination.
Yeah.
They weren't writing this in an ivory tower. They were active political revolutionaries.
Right.
This manifesto was actually commissioned by a group called the Communist League. It was meant to be a public declaration of their aims, a political pamphlet, really.
Which brings us to the manifesto itself. It's short, punchy, very direct. You said its goal was to lay out the communist aims openly, push back against the fear-mongering, the specter haunting Europe.
Yes. And the core argument, the absolute central premise, is this. All of recorded history is essentially a history of struggles between social classes.
That's the starting point for everything else.
They argue that in their time, the modern capitalist era, this struggle had simplified. It boiled down to two main opposing camps.
Which were?
On one side, you have the bourgeoisie. These are the owners of the means of production, the capital, the factories, the land.
Okay, the owners.
And on the other side, the proletariat. This is the industrial working class, the people who don't own the means of production and have to sell their ability to work, their labor power, just to survive.
And the really crucial argument, the big contradiction they see, is that capitalism, even though it's incredibly productive, actually creates the very force that will eventually destroy it.
That's the gravedigger idea.
Exactly. The proletariat, the working class created by capitalism, is, in their view, destined to overthrow the bourgeoisie.
It's a stark prediction. They saw this as an almost inevitable outcome of the system's internal logic.
And the ultimate goal of this overthrow, what comes after?
The goal is a revolution to abolish what they call bourgeois private property, not your personal belongings, but the private ownership of the means of production, and establish a classless society.
A society where, as they put it, the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all.
That's the vision.
Okay, let's dig into the chapters a bit. Chapter 1, Bourgeois and Proletarians. This sets the stage.
It does. And what's interesting is how they almost, well, admire the bourgeoisie in some ways at the start.
Really? How so?
They describe them as this incredibly revolutionary force. They smashed feudalism, unleashed productive forces on a scale never seen before, created a global market, They basically remade the world.
Pulled everyone into civilization, as they say, but then the instability kicks in.
Right. This is where the argument gets really interesting. The bourgeoisie kind of loses control of the gigantic forces it conjured up. Yeah. The system starts to suffer from these bizarre crises.
Crises of overproduction.
Exactly. Which would have sounded absurd in earlier times. Suddenly there's too much stuff being made. Factories close, workers are fired, not because there's scarcity, but because the market can't absorb it all under the rules of private property and profit.
The system's capacity to produce outstrips the social relations, the ownership structure.
Precisely. And this forces the bourgeoisie into this constant, frantic search for new markets and more intense exploitation of old ones. It's inherently unstable.
And churning within this unstable system is the proletariat. How do they describe their condition?
They're painted as basically cogs in the machine, an appendage. Their work becomes repetitive, meaningless. They're alienated from what they produce and from their own humanity, really.
Just selling their labor like any other commodity.
Exactly. Subject to all the ups and downs of the market. And they only get to live and work as long as their labor helps increase the capital of the bourgeoisie.
But the shared condition, the shared lack of property and power, is also what supposedly pushes them to unite.
Yes. Because they have, according to Marx and Engels, nothing of their own to protect within the existing system. No stake in it. Their only way forward is to destroy the whole system of private property itself. That makes them the truly revolutionary class.
Okay, that naturally leads into chapter two. Proletarians and communists. What's the role of the communists here?
They position the communists not as some separate group, but as the most politically advanced, the most clear-sighted section of the working class movement overall.
They have the theory, the understanding of the bigger picture.
That's the idea. They understand the line of march, the conditions, and the ultimate results of the proletarian movement.
And chapter two is also where they tackle that huge criticism, the abolition of property. This causes a lot of confusion, doesn't it?
It really does. And this is maybe the key clarification in the whole manifesto. They state very clearly, communism doesn't want to abolish personal property in general, the things you earn and use yourself, like the tools of an artisan, perhaps.
Right, not your toothbrush.
Exactly. What they want to abolish is bourgeois private property, that specific form of property, the private ownership of the means of production, the factories, land, capital, that allows one class to exploit the labor of another.
So it's about the system of ownership that generates capital and class division.
Precisely. They argue capital isn't a personal power. It's a social power created by collective labor. So transforming it into common property doesn't abolish personal property. It just changes the social character of property, removing its class character.
They also hit back pretty hard against other criticisms, right? Like abolishing freedom or the family.
Oh, yes. They basically say the bourgeoisie defines freedom as just free trade, the freedom to buy and sell, which includes the freedom to exploit labor.
In the family.
They argue the typical bourgeois family of their time is based on capital, on private gain. It often involves hidden or open exploitation within the family, especially of children. Communists, they say, want to replace home education with social education and stop that exploitation.
Okay. And then towards the end of chapter two, they lay out that famous 10-point program. These are transitional measures for after a revolution, right?
Yes. Steps to basically wrest control from the bourgeoisie and centralize the economy in the hands of the new state representing the proletariat.
What are some key examples, things people might recognize?
Well, there's a heavy progressive income tax. Abolition of the right of inheritance. That's a big one.
Definitely.
Centralization of credit under a national bank. State control of communication and transport. Combining agriculture with industry. And very importantly, free public education for all children and abolishing child factory labor.
So quite a radical restructuring.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The ultimate aim, though, isn't just state control forever. It's meant to lead to a situation where public power loses its political character.
Meaning
the state is no longer an instrument used by one class to oppress another. Because in theory, classes themselves would disappear.
Right. The class distinctions fade away. Okay, let's zoom out again. If we had to pull out the biggest, most fundamental themes from the manifesto, what would they be?
Okay, theme one has to be historical materialism. We touched on it, but it's foundational.
Yeah.
The economic structure, the base, shapes everything else.
Yeah.
The superstructure of politics, law, culture, ideas.
So the way we organize production influences the kind of government we have, the laws we make, even the dominant ideas we hold about fairness or success.
Exactly. It pushes you to ask, when you hear a dominant idea say, about meritocracy, whose economic interests might this idea be serving? consciously or unconsciously.
Okay, what's theme two?
The inevitability of capitalism's collapse. This is less a wish and more presented as a kind of scientific prediction based on those internal contradictions we talked about, like overproduction crises.
The system contains the seeds of its own destruction, basically.
That's the core argument. It's why they sound so confident, declaring the fall of the bourgeoisie and the victory of the proletariat equally inevitable.
All right, theme three.
That crucial point about the abolition of the bourgeois private property, again, emphasizing it's about transforming capital from a tool of class power into a shared social resource. It reframes the whole debate away from just personal possessions.
Got it. And a fourth one.
Internationalism. This is huge. The manifesto argues the working class has no country, in a sense. Their struggle transcends national borders because capitalism itself is a global system.
The famous last lines tie into that.
Precisely. Working men of all countries unite. It's a call for global solidarity against a global system.
Speaking of famous lines, the manifesto is packed with memorable, punchy quotes. Let's highlight a few.
Okay. The absolute bedrock is that opening line of chapter one. The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. That sets the lens for everything.
Yep. And then there's their take on the state. The executive of the modern state is but a committee for managing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie. Pretty blunt.
Very blunt. It argues the state isn't neutral. It primarily serves the interests of the dominant economic class.
And the line capturing that internal contradiction we discussed.
What the bourgeoisie therefore produces, above all, are its own grave diggers. The system creates the force destined to replace it. Powerful imagery.
It really is. And of course, the final call to action. The proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains. They have a world to win. Working men of all countries, unite.
That one still resonates, doesn't it? It's the ultimate rallying cry, arguing the working class has no real stake in preserving the existing system, only in replacing it.
So bringing this back to today, why should someone listening now care about these ideas from 1848? How can we apply this lens?
Well, it provides a really sharp analytical tool for understanding modern economic phenomena. Take the gig economy, for instance.
Okay. How would this apply?
Instead of getting bogged down in labels like independent contractor, the manifesto pushes you to ask the fundamental question, does this worker own capital, the means of production, the platform, the algorithm, the investment, or do they only own their labor, which they have to sell hour by hour?
Right. And usually it's the latter.
Usually. And yeah. That framework immediately helps explain the precarity, the lack of benefits, the feeling of exploitation many gig workers experience. It cuts through the jargon.
That makes sense. What about on a more personal level?
Think about alienation. The manifesto describes workers feeling disconnected from the product they make, the process of their work, even from other workers and their own potential.
That feeling of just being a small cog, doing repetitive tasks without seeing the bigger picture or feeling any real fulfillment?
Exactly that. And the manifesto helps you articulate that maybe that feeling isn't just a personal problem, but potentially a systemic feature of how work is organized under certain conditions. It gives language to that widespread sense of meaninglessness.
Okay, and one more application.
I'd say the critique of ideology. It trains you to be critical of ideas presented as just common sense or the way things have to be, especially concerning the economy.
Like the idea that constant economic growth is always good or that maximizing shareholder value is the only goal.
Precisely. The manifesto encourages you to pause and ask, okay, but whose interest does this common sense idea actually serve? It encourages a healthy skepticism towards dominant narratives.
So, wrapping up, thinking about this deep dive, what's the biggest thing that stands out to you or maybe surprised you revisiting it?
For me, it's the sheer power of its systemic critique. It doesn't just tinker around the edges. It forces you to see capitalism not as some natural, permanent state of affairs, but as a specific historical system with its own dynamics, contradictions, and potentially its own end.
It frames it as one phase in history, not the end of history.
Exactly. And that perspective, that ability to step back and analyze the entire structure, is incredibly powerful, whether you agree with the conclusions or not.
Yeah, I agree. What struck me is how it imbues the reader, or at least tries to, with the sense that society isn't fixed. That huge changes can happen, driven by these large-scale social forces and, crucially, by collective human action.
That's perhaps the most enduring insight. It's the idea that history is made and can be remade. Even beyond its specific economic predictions, the manifesto remains this foundational text for thinking critically about power, society, and the possibility of change.
A powerful tool for thought, indeed. See you next time with another remarkable thinker. another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.